What I do for my day job is a neutrino experiment. I worked on Miniboon for many years. I'm now working on Microboon. I'm actually also now a member of IceCube. I was on Double Shell and several other experiments. But I also have done a lot of work related to doing 3+ N fits, so looking at sterile neutrino fits. And when you start out and you're doing 3+ N fits, which I actually started doing some time ago, I said it's probably a decade ago, you find that when you give talks like this, that there are certain questions and comments that just happen every time you give a talk, okay? So what I'd like to do in the beginning, for the first 5 minutes or so of this talk, is to just go ahead and address those for you guys, okay? So we'll get all those out of the way, and then we'll get into the talk. So let me give you the first one. Why are you wasting my time? Low sigma signals always go away. Oh, really? Okay. Here is a very nice example of a low sigma signal that worked out just fine, thank you. This is actually the Higgs. This was the Higgs results that were brought out in 2011. So here we have 2.8 sigma coming from Atlas Gamma Gamma, 3.1 sigma coming from CMS Gamma Gamma. I point out that both of those are lower in significance than what you have for LSD and in Miniboon Nu. In that same data set, you also had the four lepton channels, and the four lepton channels were 2.1 sigma and 2.7 sigma, which are more or less in the range of what we talk about when we talk about the reactor and radioactive sources, okay? So it is not true that 2 sigma, 3 sigma signals always go away. You remember the ones that do, but it is not true. Most signals in this world actually start out at 2 or 3 sigma, and then they move on to become signals that are of higher strength. I should also say that 5 sigma and greater signals go away. In the 1980s, just as I was starting out in particle physics, the Higgs was discovered. The Higgs was discovered at 5 sigma. There is the beautiful bump that you see right there, okay? And that was a 5 sigma signal that went away in the next set of runs. So you always have to be cautious of data. And I think it's very fair to be cautious of data. But I don't think that you can come along and just say, oh, it's 2 sigma, I'm just going to throw it out, okay? All right. What I really meant, okay, you're right, Janet, 2 sigma signals don't always go away. But what I really meant is that 2 sigma unexpected signals go away, okay? All right, here's a quiz for you guys. Which of these four topics that I list here actually came out first reported at less than 3 sigma? Think about it. This is a quiz. I have found that when you give physicists quizzes, they get very excited because they want to win. Every single one of them. That is exactly right. So these were also unexpected at the time. I mean, a lot of these cases, there'll be people who will say, oh, well, I expected it. But the truth of the matter is that if I had gone out at the time and polled physicists, the vast majority of them would have said something different than what these signals actually show. And that's my definition of unexpected. Oh, really? Oh, wait. It's coming. I meant that low sigma unexpected signals, which are in tension with limits and associated with controversy, go away. That's what I meant. Oh, really? Okay. This is the discovery of the tau. Okay. And there's this wonderful article that was written by Marty Pearl in which he's talking about how his first publication was followed by years of confusion and uncertainty about the tau result. And the reason why I wanted to quote this here to you is because it has a line which I think is very important for everybody to look at, which is that indeed finding such events was just at the limit of the particle identification capability of the detectors in the mid-1970s. And that is always going to be true of every discovery. If it wasn't true, we would have already discovered it. So you're always going to be sitting at the very edge with these new signals. But maybe if the tau doesn't convince you that there are controversial signals out there, there was the neutral currents. I'm going to hook this into here. I think it will be more likely to stay on. There's the discovery of neutral current interactions. This was certainly messed up by controversy. It was certainly a case in which there was no, you know, in which there were a lot of people saying, oh, there isn't really a result out there. Or, of course, what's near and dearest to all of our hearts, there's neutrino oscillations, right? I remember Bacall standing up there and having to defend the ideas behind neutrino oscillations. So it hasn't been that long ago. I'm not that old. Okay. Look, if you have to fit a bunch of signals to get 5 sigma, then I don't believe it. Oh, really? How many people here think the Higgs was found at LHC? Raise your hands. Come on. How many of you think it's really there? Yeah, come on. Be honest. Okay. The Higgs, when it spread out in 2012, all of the signals were below 5 sigma. And you put them together, and you get to be above 5 sigma. But here, for example, this is the most recent of the ATLAS results, the CMS results. But at the time when it came out, it was 4.5 and 4.1, 4 leptons from 3.4 and 3.2. By the way, another variation on this is I don't believe fits that have a lot of poles in them. This fit has more than 1,000 pole parameters associated with it.
But it was not contradictory compared to the baseline data. Okay, we will come back to
that. So that was this one back here. That was this one back here, right there. That if it has associated with controversy and intention with limits. And but you're right. It is absolutely true that if we expect something, we are much more willing to go ahead and accept it than if we didn't expect it. But I don't think nature cares what we expect or not. So I think weighing that in is a really dangerous thing to do. But what you say is absolutely right. And there is a flip side of this that Boris brought up, which has to do with the things that we believe in, but there actually isn't any experimental evidence for at all, right? And yet we truly believe in those, or we say that other things that contradict them are not going to be right. Anyway, applause. We all believe this, so. Okay. Here's another variation on the theme, and this is a very important one for me to talk about. Look, if I take data set X, and I take data set Y, data set X rules out data set Y at greater than 90% confidence level, so why are you even bothering to do global fits? Okay? This is the Minos plus statement, and one has to be very, very careful of that, because you're not allowed, sorry guys.
In what context that statement was made, Janet?
So, what Minos plus does, for example, is they take their disappearance signal, they put it in with Bouguer, that gives them a disappearance limit, and they say, oh, that covers LS&D, so problem is solved.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
But what they've done is they are picking and choosing the data points they want to include, right? Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're leaving out all of the others, like Miniboom, for example, Miniboom new bar, all of the disappearance signals that are actually out there. And actually, they're leaving out other disappearance limits, too. The reality of it is, if you're going to sit down and do these fits, you really have to put everybody in, whether you love them or not. You know, they all have to go in. Now, there are edges to this, okay, because at some point, where do you decide not to put data in? And in our particular case, what we've decided to do is to put in experiments that are sensitive from 0.01 in delta n squared up to about 100 in delta n squared. So we're keeping ourselves in that sensitivity range. And the other thing we've decided not to do in our fits, but other people choose to do, is we have decided to stick with only oscillation experiments. And some of these other fits are trying to put in the mass limits, which can be translated into an oscillation limit. I'd like to do that at some point in our fits in the future, but that's something that we haven't been able to do. But other than that, we try to put all the data sets in and use them all.
In the best of all worlds, experiments are different. They have different systematic effects. So how do you decide? You just include all of them?
Right, and I'm going to show you why it's so important. That is one of the important statements that could be made in this entire talk that I'm going to give, and it's going to be related to section 2 of my talk. We're going to come back to that, and I'd like to talk to you more about that when we get to section 2, okay? Because it's going to turn out that having these experiments be sensitive to different systematics, I think really helps you resolve things in a way that if you decide you're only going to stick with one, you end up with problems. So you're writing what you're saying, and if we can find ways to bring these other ones in, I think it's a legitimate statement. Let me come back.
Okay, it's just not systematic errors, it's also systematic biases.
So most of these experiments have tried to be blind analyses in recent times. I would tell you that since CDHS wasn't, but NOMAD was, well, everything since NOMAD, I think you'll find was a blind analysis. Okay, the last comment has to do with the number of parameters that you put into your bid. And the line that I've heard on this that is the best line, I think, is with 4 parameters, I can fit an elephant, and with 5, I can make his trunk wiggle. And it turns out I'm not going to argue with this one. There are 3 theorists out there who have nothing better to do, who have managed to make an elephant out of 4 parameters, and the nose actually wiggles. So if you go to this site right here, they have they connect you up to it, and you can watch the elephant wiggle his nose. Okay. That was in the American Association of Physics Teachers. And it really was a lot of fun. So this is going to bring me now to my talk. Okay.
It worries me a bit that they're all Germans, by the way. We're German institutions.
So it must be true.
There's one question you didn't include. Can I ask that?
Sure.
So many people are not planning to include data in their analysis below 475 maybe.
Actually, that's not a true statement. I can talk to you about that in just 1 second, but I have to get done drawing my own. And it needs a tail. Okay. To answer your question, so we always planned sidebands. And so what we always planned was that we would have a region that was lower that we had intended to look at, and it was going to be the region that we opened just before we opened the other box. Mm-hmm. We were not thinking that we would find a signal in that region, because if you look at where LS&D is, you discover that that signal would be most clear in this middle region, right? Mm-hmm. But we thought it was a really good sideband, and we'd always intended to look at it and publish it. Turns out what nature gave us, if you interpret it as oscillations in neutrino mode, is a lower mixing angle than what you have in antineutrino mode. And so it showed up in the intermediate box, if you interpret it as oscillations. But we always intended to publish that box.
So the emphasis changed from here after you found that.
Yeah, that's what nature does for you. But we left the cuts exactly where they were. We've never changed our cuts since then. And we didn't change the cuts then. We had a set of cuts we used. But the emphasis, you're right, is absolutely different. Yeah, we looked at where the statistics appear.
Yeah, for a while, you showed 2 different analyses. One is the threshold at 200, one is the threshold at
I still do when I show my talk.
Okay.
Not this one, because I'm not going into this. I mean, I just go straight to this is what we see. But if I'm doing a colloquium or something like that, I always start out with that part shaded out and show the part where we didn't see a signal, and then show that other part. So it really depends on the style of the person who's doing it, but I usually do that. And it's important because this is a very important point. Nature turned out to be, if this is oscillations, nature is more complicated than what we expected. Nature is not 3+1 is what that means. And so we have to be prepared for that in blind analyses. So the way that you can handle that is you can keep taking data, having set now what your cuts are, and see what happens after that. But I think we were very straightforward and fair in Mini Moon. We tried extremely hard to put everything on the table as it stood. All right. I want to talk about 5 elephants that are in the room, of which Mini Moon is one of them. Mini Moon is an elephant. LS&D is an elephant. Reactors. The gallium. And I also want to talk about T decay, which is a tiny little elephant that just wandered into the room. Okay. Then I want to talk about fits that give us fits, okay? Because it turns out we have a fitting problem, okay? And I'm going to illustrate our fitting problem with a toy model, but it is very, very relevant to the overall fits that I want to discuss with you, okay? And I don't know how to solve that problem, okay? So if you guys have solutions for me, that's what I'm looking for and why I'm here. Okay, so it would be great if you did. And the third has to do with why I don't intend to do fits for the rest of my life. Okay, if I can prevent it, okay? I think that what these fits do for you is they give you guidance on the next experiment you need to run, okay? And that is why I do these fits. I am an experimentalist. I like to develop new experiments. I need guidance on where I'm going, and that's what I'm trying to get out of it. And really not a lot more, okay? So I'm not going to try to make any conclusions or discoveries out of these fits. What I'm going to try to do is get some guidance out of the fits. Okay, so that's what I wanted to talk about. So that's my beginning, okay? One of the things that I wanted to be sure to say to you is that everything I'm talking about is preliminary. I wanted to be able to talk to you about how the sausage gets made. This is not stuff that you should run out and say, Janice said this fit did this, okay, because we're still working on these ideas, okay? Okay, so let me begin with my elephants. The first elephant, which is the largest elephant, is LS&D. And LS&D comes from a decay at rest experiment. And I really happen to like decay at rest experiments. I think that they are really, really nice experiments. And so what happens in a decay at rest experiment of this particular type is you have a pion that decays to a muon and a muon neutrino. Then your muon is going to decay into an electron neutrino, a new mu bar, and a mu electron out of here. Positron. I want to go. There we go. My pi minus is mostly capture. And one of the things that you would like to do in a really good decay at rest experiment is build your target so that all of your decay, your pi minus is captured. In fact, that was not true at LS&D. That targeting system was built for many reasons. So in the future, if you want to do a really good decay at rest experiment, you want to design for that. Nevertheless, the new E bar that you find in something like this is actually, in the case of LS&D, at the 8 times 10 to the minus 4 level compared to the new mu flavor. Sorry, Lord. All right, let's start this again. This theme has the following structure. The new mu that decays, this is a two-body decay, so that's going to be at about 29 MeV. Then these decays, it's a three-body decay, so you end up with your new mu's looking a lot like that, and you end up with your new e's looking like this, okay? And it's got equal amounts of each flavor and very, very little of the new e bar. So this is an ideal place if you want to do new e bar goes to new e bar, okay? New e bar goes to new e bar is a really, really nice choice for an experimentalist because there is this kind of interaction, which is called inverse beta decay, where if you have your new E bar and it hits a proton, what you get out is you get out a positron plus a neutron. And that means you end up with a coincidence signal because what happens is you see your flash from your positron initially and then you see the neutron capture a little bit later. And so that's really nice because that helps you get rid of backgrounds. So this is a really beautiful signal. The only problem with LS&D is it doesn't end up with a high rate of statistics. So what you're looking at here is you're looking at the events. They're plotted in L over E. So it turns out LS&D was located at 30 meters along the beamline. And what you see is you see the data points. They had systematics and statistics added in quadrature. And you see their backgrounds, their beam-related backgrounds in the green on the red. And then you see that the data points are sitting high. So they can add in a signal. The example signal they add in is the one that's in blue that you see right there. If you do this and you say, okay, well, I seem to have new E bars appearing. How come my new E bars are appearing? Well, let's say it's oscillations. If it's oscillations and you're seeing things at about an L over E of 1, because of the oscillation formula, which I think everybody here knows, but just write it down. it turns out that if this is on the order of one, then you're going to be sitting right at the peak of the oscillations. So if my L over E is about one, then that tells you you're picking out a delta M squared of about one. So not very surprisingly, you end up with the LS&D result sitting up here, okay? What does that tell you if you already know that there are three neutrinos out there? Well, if I have three neutrinos, and I have two delta M squareds that are well measured, delta M squared solar, and delta M squared atmospheric, then this plus that has to add up to the third delta M squared. And I will never be able to take 7 times 10 to the minus 4 plus 3 times 10 to the minus 3, 7 times 10 to the minus 5, excuse me, 3 times 10 to the minus 3, add them together and get 1. That's just never going to work, right? So therefore, what this seems to indicate is maybe you would want to introduce an extra delta M squared, LS&D, which you could introduce if you introduce an extra neutrino. So this is what led people to start thinking about what we call 3 plus 1 models, okay? And the 3 plus 1 models that we talk about, this is much, much larger than these two. So we use what's called the short baseline approximation, where all of the three light neutrinos are considered to have delta M squared equal to 0, and I only have one splitting then, which is my splitting delta M squared LS&D, which makes it easy to fit, right? Because this is just two neutrino oscillations, I'm just fitting to that. So when I talk about doing these fits, I have set delta M squared atmospheric and delta M squared solar to 0. And that's going to matter in a couple of minutes, okay? All right. So the next one on the list then is Miniboom. Miniboom was actually motivated because LS&D was out there. And we decided to run Miniboom in neutrino mode first, which I think was our big mistake. Our number one mistake was running in neutrino mode first. And the reason why I say that is because, well, first of all, let me just show you. These are the Miniboom results. We have from 200 MeV up to 3 GeV. In fact, we really don't reconstruct it above 1 GeV very well. Okay, it's very hard to do that in a Turing belt detector. And so just bringing up what it was that Danny was talking about, we had thought that our most optimal place for looking for signal was at about 500 up to about 1 based on LS&D. Okay? And one of the things you'll notice is here in anti-neutrinos, we do have an excess in that region. In fact, if you take the excesses that Miniboom has and you plot them onto LS&D, what you discover is that our results of running in anti-neutrino mode, which is what we did second, okay, are actually in good agreement with LS&D. If we had run anti-neutrino mode first, we would never have had any of the controversies that we have. But people start out with neutrino mode for very good reason, okay? You get 3 times the rate in the beam line, and you get 2 times the rate from the cross section. So if you're starting out and you want to know your detector is working well, you are nuts if you're running an anti-neutrino mode first, right? And when we ran, we ended up with a result then, if you move over to the left from where LS&D sits and sine squared 2 theta, then what happens is you end up with very little signal predicted in this region, right? And your signal ends up down there. So this is what we got, okay? And it was very interesting talk, I have to tell you, when we opened the box and I had to figure out what the hell we were going to say in front of everybody, because it was not what we expected at all, okay? I want to make a couple of points here that I think are worth pointing out because there's some mistakes that people make. You'll notice that our biggest background is this orange background down here at low energies. That is our pi naught misID. So pi naught goes to 2 photons. When you're at Miniboom energies, what happens when a pi naught decays to 2 photons is one of 2 things. You either get a decay where, and you lose it, you get a misID. You either get a decay which was back-to-back and then boosted along the direction of that back-to-back decay. So one photon is strong and the other photon is weak. Or you get a case where one photon exits the detector. We are not at energies where you actually get the 2 photons to merge. That just doesn't happen to us. We will not mistake two rings for a single ring. We may not be able to take the blob you get from two rings and say it's definitely two rings, but it doesn't look like an electron. So that's not what happens. So what happens is we're losing one of these photons either because it exits or because it is weak and going backwards, okay? So in that particular case, what I'm saying is that this pi naught is essentially at rest, okay? And if that pi naught is essentially at rest, then these photons have 70 eV or so. And so they're coming out at some angle, and the combination of 70 eV of visible energy plus that angle is what is bringing them into this plot. But there's a sharp cutoff of them at eVis of 70 eV. So what happens is in the next spin down, this actually turns over. So why do we not show you the next spin down? The reason why we don't show you the next spin down is because it is full of Michel electrons from cosmic rays that have come in and take a long time to decay. And that produces an electron which can be up to 52 eV, but it's very near to a phototube we can misreconstruct in the type of detector that we have. And so that gets into the lower bin. And so that's why it's not worth showing you the next bin. I do think that that bin is going to be very exciting for microboot, because microboot is not going to be confused by that. So one of the big things to come up is what happens when you go lower. Okay, so that's mini boom. Now, let's look at this again. What you see there is you see that the two solutions for neutrino and antineutrino are looking different, right? That the neutrino mode is looking like it's sitting at smaller sine squared 2 theta than the antineutrino mode is. So, how do you address this problem? Well, one way to address this problem is to introduce the idea of CP violation. Okay? So what CP violation does is it allows you to have a difference between neutrinos and antineutrinos. If I do that, I introduce more parameters. In fact, I have to thank Vern Barber because he was the person who actually really helped us do the original calculations on this one. You introduce more parameters because you end up with what's called a 3+2 model. And the reason for that is because you need a term which has an interference here, right? And if I was deciding that I was going to look at, for example, the interference between delta M squared atmospheric and delta M squared LSD at an L over E of 1, what you find out is that interference term immediately drives you down to just a few percent effect. And that's before you ever multiply by any mixing angles. It would just be too tiny to be seen. So I need two large delta M squareds that are about within an order of magnitude of each other in order to explain it. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, good. So that's why I am now at a 3+2 model. So now I have delta M squared 2, delta M squared 1, and then I have my other guys 2. So they're all sitting down like that. Okay? So if I do that, then I can go ahead and I can look at neutrinos and antineutrinos separately. And it is the mini-boom data that really drives you, I think, to look at the 3+2 possibilities, okay? There are some other elephants out there too. These elephants are disappearance elephants instead of appearance elephants. They do a slightly different trick. So the ones that I've just shown you were all nu mu to nu e, or nu mu bar to nu e bar. Now these are all going to be electron-flavored disappearance. We have no evidence of any muon-flavored disappearance. So the next elephant is the reactor experiments. And they are a very interesting and controversial set of experiments at the moment. What happened was that we started out with a set of experiments, a large number of experiments that had taken data in the past, and they were all in perfect agreement with the predictions that were out there. The predictions, though, were old. They were probably about 15, 20 years old. A lot of data had been taken in the meantime, so they went out and redid the predictions. And when they redid the predictions, all of the data went from lining up along unity to lining up to less than unity. Okay? And that produced what they call the reactor anomaly. So this happened in, I can't remember when it happened. It must have happened in around 2010 or so, something like that. Yeah. And so some other things have happened too. So experiments have been running out there, Reno, Double Show, Dye Bay, and they have both near and far detectors. And all of these experiments have been indicating that if this is your ratio of data to Monte Carlo, this is ratio of data to predicted, for example, or data minus Monte Carlo divided by Monte Carlo, all of them show an unexpected extra flux sitting at about 4.5 MeV. This bump really became clear as of neutrino 2014, but you could find it in all of the publications earlier, okay? There are some explanations for where this might be coming from. Dwyer and Langford have a publication out that suggests the origin of the bump. They pick out some specific, very rare decays that might be happening in reactors that could actually explain this. It's a very interesting thing. SHOW actually saw the bump too. The SHOW data set is indicated by the dots that I show you here. I made this plot pre-reactor anomaly, so everything lies on the 1.0 line. What is very interesting is that the Bouguer data does not show the bump, okay? And it is the Bouguer data that matters for the reactor anomaly studies, because you can see that the errors on this are much, much smaller than any other data set that is out there. So we've been playing around with these different ideas related to the reactor anomaly. And also, I should just say that I think Anna Hayes was here, right, and gave a talk. So she and Jerry Garvey have been raising questions about whether we really understand the systematic error on that reactor anomaly also. I've been very frustrated by them because they will not give me a quantitative value for how much they think that systematic error should go up. And it drives me nuts when people go, oh, well, you shouldn't believe the data set, but we're not going to tell you, like, by how much we think it's off. Okay, I think that's a crummy thing to do. But if I go ahead and increase this by 5%, and increase the error by 5%, or if I go ahead and manufacture a bump in the Bouguer data, it turns out it makes zero difference to the fits. It makes absolutely no difference to the conclusions that I am going to make here. So all of the most recently raised issues about the reactor anomaly don't address it, okay? If something comes up where they actually say that value of the reactor anomaly is wrong and the prediction should move, which is different from saying the error should be larger, that will have an effect. But just...
I don't understand the statement. Mm-hmm. If the normalization error of the reactor flux goes to 4%, mm-hmm. then the reactor anomaly gets like 1.7 sigma.
Yes, but what happens is that you end up with a carved out region on one side, right?
Yeah.
Oh, so it turns out the reactors are not very strong in the fit as it is, okay? And if you take it down from where it's at 2-point-something sigma to 1.7 sigma, it doesn't really change the strength of the fit, and I can give you the change in chi-squared, it's pretty small. And then the...
So you're assuming with the gallium anomaly, right?
The gallium and the mini boom. I do fits with everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think the normalization, if you're changing the normalization, if you enlarge it, the normalization error, then the reactor anomaly goes away.
No.
But it's not only
the reactor anomaly never goes away. It becomes less significant, but it never goes away.
All right.
So what I will tell you is that it's all not strong enough in the fits already, but it pulls it that much. Okay? But interestingly, the bump didn't matter. The reason why the bump doesn't matter is because the bump is appearing L independently. And it turns out when we fit Bouguer, we fit the Bouguer 40 meters and we fit the Bouguer 15 meters. And it is not possible to come up with an oscillation signal that will give you a bump in both of those data sets. So it just doesn't come in, right, in terms of pulling the fit around. I was really worried what that bump might mean. Okay, then we come to our smallest elephant that we presently include in the fits. The smallest elephant is the radioactive sources. These are from Galax and Sage. And they are at about 2.1 sigma, I think it is. I have to look up exactly what it is. This was also a complicated data set for us to work with on this. There has been new data related to the cross-section of the gallium detectors. And so Gionti, so there's three people who do fits basically out there that you know, votes against each other. There's us. There's Gionti's group, and then there's also Jakob Kopp, Antoni, and Schwetz. They all work together. And Gionti has found that if you take recent data that came from Freckers, and you combine it with a calculation that came from Wick-Haxton, you can really increase the cross-section. The result of that is that it really increases your the probability of your fits here, and it makes a much larger signal. We're not sure that this is the right thing to do, and we're not completely sure we follow exactly what Wick did in his calculations, and so we're trying to understand this. We're thinking about adding this as an uncertainty or as a systematic error. But I would be really interested. I can give people papers if you would like to read this and interpret it for us. I would love help on that.
Is this calculation by Wick old? The calculation from the 90s or is it a new one?
It's the calculation from the 90s. It's not a new one. But it's gotten, it gets mixed in with this new result from Freckers. Okay. So more or less, this is what we end up with then, is we put the whole thing together. And this is actually showing you all of our signals that we put into our fits. And you end up with appearance, and you end up with disappearance, and you're getting a result which is consistent with what you would expect from our model. What is extremely important here are a couple of things. Number one, for appearance and disappearance, you want delta m squared to agree. Okay? And the other thing that you would like is for any particular disappearance channel, you want sine squared 2 theta to be greater than your appearance. I said that in a funny way, so let me just. Appearance is a single channel, right? Disappearance is multiple channels. So therefore, you expect that the mixing angle that you will extract will have a sine squared 2 theta, which is on the right, compared to the sine squared 2 theta of the appearance. So this could have come out completely wrong. If disappearance had ended up on this side of this plot, then this would not work. Okay? So now suddenly there is a new kid on the block, and they are not included in our fits yet. Their paper only just came out, and
Could
that is T to K.
Can you go back to the previous slide before you move on?
Yeah.
So the disappearance appearance seems to go in the right direction, but where they agree.
So I'll talk to you a little more about that because I'll show you better slides than this. This is kind of a cartoon.
Okay.
So I'll show you real fits and with lines on them so that you can line them up.
And then you're hiding real natural disappearance as well, right? Because that will contradict it.
You know, actually in this there's already some constraints from null experiments, which is why that guy is cut off and over on his side. So this is a cartoon. It was mostly to just talk about what you actually expect for this. So I'll show you the fits in just a minute. Let me briefly just point out T to K out there. T to K has just brought out a result, which is mu e disappearance. One of the questions that came out from Mari Goodman was, how is it possible that if you expect mu mu to mu e, that you can look for mu e disappearance? And the answer is you can, because the fluxes which are causing your signal are different. And so, for example, here is the flux which is causing their, this one is the mu e's, right? This is the new flux, this is their new mu flux. So their new mu flux is actually peaked over here to the side of where the new mu flux is peaked. So you can, in fact, end up getting a disappearance signal in an experiment with an appearance signal. And in fact, this argument that I put up here tells you that, in fact, you expect a disappearance signal to dominate compared to an appearance signal. So I don't think Mari's question was a good one in that sense. But I do think it is a good one in the sense that when you are trying to analyze all of these data sets, what it tells you is that you need to worry about new mu disappearance and new e disappearance and new mu to new e all at once. And I will tell you, we don't do that for Miniboo, okay? We will, this is one of the big steps that we are about to take, is to make it possible to do that. But it is very tricky to do that because the way that Miniboo gets its new E background, most of our new E background comes from this kind of a decay. It turns out that because of the kinematics, the new UCC events that we see in the detector can give us the kinematics of this guy. With the kinematics of this guy, it is easy to predict than what you expect for that. So our new mu's predict our new E background. And if what you're going to do is you're going to go out and do an analysis where you say, oh, you didn't actually see all the new mu's because some disappeared, you have to be able to work all the way backwards and change the new E. And that's a tricky thing to do. I think we know how to do it. We're in the process of enacting that right now. But it is something that is in our fits, which is not correct for sure. Now, Joachim, what he's done is he just says, well, if new mu disappears in the bin, then I'm going to let new E be affected in that bin. But that's not correct. This new E is going to be a much lower energy than that new mu in general.
This is not entirely true.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in our field, putting this new E to oscillate or not doesn't make much of a difference. Because in the end, we're looking at mix and angles of at most 10%. And a 10% difference in the background, well, what does it do for you? You don't have very large error bars. So
actually, I'll get to the point where I will tell you about changing the shape of the mini boon signal by 10% effects, and it's going to matter in terms of how you interpret the signal. So if you change the shape of the mini boon signal, which you can do in a couple of different ways, one of which is to allow things to disappear, another is to allow the systematic errors. In either one of those cases, you can actually get a different result than what you expect.
I think you can get the configurability from the long, but if you fit with the disappearance, the new experiments, you probably don't get much of a difference.
All right, so I have to say, we have at this point only taken it to the point where we're working on mini-boom. Sure. I haven't gotten it to the next step yet. So I can't address that. Okay, so there's TDK, and so here's TDK's disappearance signal, which you can see is tiny. It's the difference between what you see here in the red line and what you see here in the blue line. This shows you their allowed regions at 68% confidence level and 90% confidence level. And there are real systematics involved in this, which have to do with photons that are coming in from the side. So for us to be able to use these data sets, it is absolutely essential that they make a data release for us, where we have a correlated error matrix that we can really understand the systematics that they have put into this analysis. They haven't yet done that. But this is a common thing these days in particle physics. Most experiments do data releases. So I'm very proud of MiniBoom, and that what we do is we do really comprehensive data releases. So if you want to work with our data, you can find this all on the web, and we give you information about all of the events. We give you information on how to use them. We give you instructions. We give you who to call if you're stuck. Okay? So there's really absolutely no excuse, I would tell you, if in fact you aren't able to use our data properly. Okay? And I bring this up because of Icarus. Okay? So the Icarus group decided to analyze mini boon data points by reading them out of a paper, I guess. In fact, interestingly, in the same Icarus talk, and Neutrino 2014, the exact same talk, seven slides apart, they show two contradictory plots. Now, this is an L over E, and this is an E over L. But you can flip them, okay? And what you see here in these plots is that they have managed to calculate for mini boom at our highest point of oscillation in L over E, about 1%. That's pretty close to actually right. Over here, you'll notice that this data point is above 2%. Okay? This one is way wrong, and this one's just wrong. Okay? And if you do things like that, what we will have to do is put a paper on the archive which explains how to make these plots and explains to you what you did wrong. Okay? Because we can reproduce both of these plots now. It took us a long time because Icarus will not respond to us. Moreover, they published that plot. That is in a published journal now. And they will not respond at all. Okay? So these are the guys that Fermilab has decided to base its future on.
That's a bit of a strong statement, Janet.
No, I'm note that Big Brother is watching.
I want this to be recorded.
That's a very strong statement. There are many other partners, Janet.
No, I'll tell you, not for the short baseline, far detector, okay? And the short baseline far detector has got to work before you can build that long baseline detector.
Why?
Because you don't have a liquid argon detector that works yet. And you're not going to build 34 kilotons out of what you have right now.
Yes, I know, but the far detector is already built. It's called Icarus.
Oh, that is so not true. So you want to hear this?
No.
No, let me tell you this. This gets better and better, okay? Icarus, we have a whole detector to bring to you. Oh, but our electronics is really old, so we should replace the electronics. And our photodetection system doesn't work, so we should replace the photodetection system. And our cryo system is just this behemoth, and so you shouldn't bring it. You should get a better cryo system. And it's no sense sending a cryostat over from Italy. And so you could have the TPC, the field cage is not the right drift distance, so you need to build a new field cage. But you could have the TPC, except that you want to make the TPC taller, so even the wires don't fit.
Yes, but it's not the right tech. It's not the near detector. The one that building is built in the way that you would build LB&E.
Not right now. It isn't. Right now, what they're planning to do is not the way that they plan to build LB&E. I agree with you that they need to. So what I would really, really like to see at Fermilab in the short baseline system is, in fact, a 1 kiloton or more version of what LB&E will be. And I think that's absolutely essential.
That would be nice.
So the statement that I am making here is that is not what you're getting at the moment.
You got $100 million?
You know what?
That's a lot of cost.
But there is a LOI for liquid argon R&D at CERN. Fine, which has gone through it, you must be aware of that. And what will be done in Fermilab, yes, you are right that there is such a move, but it is not yet finalized, fine?
Right, I'm trying to head it off by making these comments.
Okay.
That is exactly what I'm saying. I mean, I'm really invested in the liquid argon. I do a lot of work on my stuff like that. So I'm actually quite concerned about what's going on. And I am, and one of the big problems with the liquid argon has to do with how much it actually costs.
And one thing
is a very expensive solution to this problem. The truth of the matter is you will get a better, I will show you at the end what you can do with the short baseline program at Fermilab, and you would get a better result if what you did was you built a large oil detector.
And one thing I will also like to add,
for $20 million.
That the LBNF, or the, whatever it is called, the far detector, which is proposed to be 40 kiloton, is not a single detector, it will be multiple modules.
Right, so that's why I think you only need to build about the 1 kiloton.
Yeah.
You need to build a 1 module size. And you need to build 1 module.
So what happened to the 1 kiloton liquid argon detector that was at one time proposed at Fermilab?
So what happened was the politics of the $100 million. If you want to build a 1 kiloton detector like that, it's going to cost you more than $100 million. Okay? And the U.S. decided they didn't have $100 million to do this, even though this is what they intend for their far future program. So then you have to be willing to go out into the world and see what people will have. Whereupon Icarus said, we will bring you a detector, and we'll bring it free. Okay? And then it has evolved from there. Okay.
The mini moon story.
It's not that. It's not necessarily that. I'd like to defend that. Okay? Because I think.
I knew you would.
Right. What happened with Mini Boom is actually an interesting one, because with Mini Boom we actually built 50% of what was actually planned. Right. So it is exactly what was always planned, 50% of it. And we put in a proposal to build the other half, Boom, which was our plan to move from Mini Boom to Boom. That was turned down. It was turned down on the basis by the PAC that the Boom system that was proposed would not reach 5 sigma in anti-neutrino running. Although in the neutrino running is actually the most complicated and interesting question. But that system does better than what the short baseline system will do. And I'll talk about that at the end. And that system requires actually no R&D. You can just build it. It looks exactly like Mini Boom. Okay, I do want to say that I've done my 5 elephants, but there are a lot of other guys out there who have results, and we've tried to include all of those results. In a particular case that I wanted to point out to you because they're important and I don't think they're very well known, is this case of doing the Carmen and LS&D cross-section measurements, okay? So both Carmen and LS&D presented cross-section measurements which were muon carbon. And you can treat Carmen as the near detector to LS&D in these measurements. So you can take these cross-section measurements and you can ask how well do they agree? Okay, we understand what this beam looks like very well because it is a decay at rest beam, so we already know that flux. So we can play these two detector cross-section measurements off each other, and you can go out and you can get a region which is ruled out. And so what you end up with is you end up with this actually making a big bite in the gallium. Okay, and so that matters a lot. The gallium turns out to be incredibly weak because of that. Okay, so we go out and we do our fit. We put it all together. This is the list of all of the ones that really make a major impact. And we end up with plots that look like this. And we end up with chi-squares that we measure. We look at chi-squared null, we look at 3+1, we look at 3+2. We see, wow, you know, look at that. That's a probability that's so much higher than the null. So why are we not thrilled? Why do we not say, 3+1 is a beautiful fit, 3+2 is a beautiful fit? We're so excited, okay? And the reason for that gets into when you start actually looking at everything, okay? And there's going to be a couple of things that are going to deceive us in the fits if we only look at the chi-squared, okay? One of the big things that will deceive you in the fits has to do with you if you have extra bins which are contributing where you don't expect to see a signal. And now keep in mind, we're scanning a delta m squared in a sine squared 2 theta space. So what that means is that inevitably, in experiments, you're going to end up with cases where some of the energy bins might not contribute, because it's only from a specific energy on down that you would actually expect to have a signal. So if what I do is I take an experiment and I keep adding in extraneous bins, okay, then what's going to happen is that, yeah, my chi-squared is going to keep going up, but my DOF is going to keep going up, and if this goes to infinity, this is going to go to 1. Okay, so I'm going to get a really good fit. So the extraneous bins are a really big problem for us when we do these fits. Okay? But there's more of a problem, too. When we're doing the 3+1 fits, if what we do is we go out and we do 3+1 and we look at, now we keep the data set, but we split it in two ways, so neutrino and antineutrino. And so this is what I was waiting to show you today, because these are real, not just cartoons. And here you have sine squared 2 theta along this axis, you have delta m squared along this axis. These are hard to read, so I put some lines on. The lines are in arbitrary positions, but they're at the same position on this plot as in this plot. So you can get a sense of how well they line up. And if you look at that, you say, well, that's maybe a near miss or something, but that doesn't look too bad. But over here, you can see that there's a real problem when what we do is we divide it between appearance and disappearance. Okay? So this is something which is very well known these days, that there is a tension between appearance and disappearance, and I think you see it beautifully right there. Now, you can say, well, is this going to show up in 3+2? And the problem with any time you're working in 3+2 is that you suddenly have all these extra parameters, and it's really hard to figure out once you get beyond a 3D space how to actually look at things. But you can get a hint of what it will look like if what you do is you now take all of your NuBAR data set and all of your new data set, and in each of these cases, you divide it into appearance and disappearance. And what you see is that actually, the tensions are somewhat relieved, okay, if you look at these pictures. So here, you can really find a point that would work for both of them, okay? That is in the anti-neutrinos, pay attention to that, because your issue comes up in neutrinos, where it's hard to find a point that really is in the red, and hits all of them, but you can see this, right? And
what's the red and blue?
Oh, the blue is 99% confidence level, and the red. Red is no. Red is 90, right? The red is 90. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So the neutrino data set is where the problem is coming from. Okay. So we started thinking about this. And actually, you know, I'm interested in that because that's where the mini-boom strange issues are also, and mini-boom is driving a lot of that. And we started thinking about how it is that you actually talk about these issues. I've way gotten off my my list of things here. I only have 10 minutes? Oh, I got a Zoom. All right, I'm going to move ahead then. The way that you measure these tensions, I have way too much material, but I will cut off, I promise. I won't keep you on here. The way you measure these tensions is by a method which has been developed by Meltonian Schwetz, which is the parameter goodness of fit. And the way the parameter goodness of fit works is you do separate fits. You do a fit to your global data set, and you're going to get the best fit, a chi-squared associated with the best fit, okay? Then you take your global data set and you divide it into appearance and disappearance. And in both of these cases, you now do a separate new fit, okay? So there's three separate fits you've done, to global, appearance, and disappearance. And you can form what turns out to be something that ends up looking like a chi-squared, which is called the chi-squared PG, which is the global minus the chi-squared appearance plus the chi-squared disappearance, okay? And you can read their paper, and their paper is in my notes here. Here it is. PH-0304176, and you can learn all about the fact that that really does come out looking like a chi-squared. And also, they derive for you in that paper the number of degrees of freedom you should associate with this new kind of statistic. So in this case, we have something which is the number of free parameters in the global fit. This is the number of free parameters in the appearance fit, and this is the number of free parameters in the disappearance fit, okay? And if you work out NTG, which is what you should treat as the degrees of freedom, it turns out that it should be NApp plus NDIS minus NBlob, okay? And they derive that for you, all right? So from first principles, you can know what your NPG ought to be if this whole theory works, okay? Because you can plug in the numbers. So let's just plug in the numbers for the 3 plus 1 model, okay? If we plug in the numbers for the 3 plus 1 model, for a global fit, you have three parameters. It's UE4 squared, U mu 4 squared, and you also have delta M squared, okay? This is for global. For disappearance, we're going to fit both the data set for the electron disappearance and the data set for muon disappearance, and they need to come out of the same delta M squared. So again, there's three and three. But for appearance, what you end up with is a mixing angle, which is the multiple of UE4 times U mu 4, okay? Squared when you put it in. And you end up with a delta M squared. So this has two parameters, okay? So what this tells you is that NTG for our model is going to be equal to 2. If their theory is right, NPG will always be equal to 2, okay? So now I can invent a toy model, and I do, because I needed to understand what the heck was going on in this model. So the toy model that I am going to invent is going to be one where I have three different types of experiments. One of them is appearance, one of them is disappearance, and one of them is one of them is electron flavored disappearance, and the other is muon flavored disappearance. And I'm going to set up my model so that I have a signal in my model, okay? And my model then is going to have the following parameters. Okay? That's my model. I can go out and I can throw my experiment. So I throw my experiment. And this experiment is going to go from 200 MeV to 1000 MeV because that's the range I like. if you plug this in, I'm going to assume that we have a flux such that the number of events in every bin, if there was no effect, would be flat in 2000. Okay? That's completely arbitrary, but I was just looking for some numbers. In which case, my appearance signal, if this is about 50 and this is about 300, is going to look like that. And both my disappearance signals are going to look alike because I chose the same values here, right? And so if this is 2000, this is 200, this is 300, this is 1000, and it goes down to a little bit below, above 1000, so it looks like that. Okay? So that's what my true underlying signal looks like. And then I can just throw data points. I mean, these error bars are way too big. When you put in 1,000, you get almost 2,000, you get almost very, very tiny errors around it, right? But I put in the right statistical fluctuations around it, okay? And I'm going to run each of these experiments 1,000 times, okay? If I do that, then what I can do is I can do my prescription, where first I fit for global, then I fit for appearance, then I fit for disappearance, and in each of my 1,000 experiments, I'm going to get a chi-squared. So if I go ahead and I do that, this is what I get. And your chi-squared distributions have a shape to them, which is well-defined if it's a chi-squared, and you can fit that shape and extract the number of degrees of freedom. Okay? And I can write up the formula for it, but anyway. You can see here that theoretically we expected 13 degrees of freedom, and we basically got that. Very nice for appearance. Same for disappearance. You know, that looks good. Global, that looks good. And most importantly for the parameter goodness of fit, I got 2. That's what I should have gotten. Okay? So everything looks really good, huh? Okay. Now, I'm going to say, okay, well, what happens if I add a systematic error? And if I add a systematic error, where I introduce my systematic error as a pull term, and I use a systematic error, so this is how I'm doing my fits now, my systematic errors are coming in as pull terms. If I add a Gaussianly distributed systematic error, so for example, my experiments calibrated their detector every time, and it was always different in every run, and it ends up Gaussianly distributed around some calibration value. If you do that, and you run, you end up with 2. It looks great. It looks exactly like it should. The next thing I can do, though, is introduce a background, which introduces a systematic error that is not Gaussianly distributed. And this happens all the time in experiments. So let me give you an example. Let's take appearance. And let's say that there's something which causes a misidentification in appearance, say pi naughts. And I go to the particle data book, and I look up what kind of pi naught background I expect. And the particle data book says it's this value plus or minus, say, 0.15 or something. Then I subtract that off of my data set, and what's left over should be a signal. But what's in the particle data book isn't right. The true answer is somewhere within that error that the particle data book quoted, and it is not Gaussianly distributed. It is always the same value. Nature has one value for the true underlying cross-section, right? So in every one of my 1,000 experiments that I run, the true underlying value is going to be a specific offset, always the same. So this is a systematic error that is no longer Gaussianly distributed, okay? And I'm going to start off with one that's flat. So now my signal plus my background, which is a residual background that I do not know as an experimentalist, but nature put in there. Okay, so this is what I ended up measuring. Nevertheless, I'm suspicious that nature might have put something in there, so I put in a pull term, and I look to see, you know, if I get a value for the pull term. So I go ahead and I run. And so what happens then is that I end up with a kind of crummy-looking appearance fit because I did some bad things, right, when I put in that background. And I end up with a disappearance fit that's not changed because I didn't put in a background. I end up with a global fit that's crummy-looking because I put in that background. And when I take the difference for the parameter goodness of fit, it cancels. and you get back 2 degrees of freedom. So this flat background, even though it was not Gaussianly distributed, did not mess up my fit. And I am happy. I think that's great. Right up until I think about what other kinds of backgrounds I might have. And in fact, one might imagine that instead of looking like a flat background, one might have an exponential-like background for one's pi naughts or whatever they are. Okay? So it might look like the green curve that you see there. And in this particular case, I've really exaggerated it, so you can see the background is very large compared to the signal. But anyway, this is a very interesting case, because when I put in this case, unlike the flat background, which is entirely uncorrelated in shape to my signal, that background has a correlation factor to my signal that I have put in at 0.75 of 60%. So now my Gaussian, my non-Gaussian background looks like a signal, okay? And now I'm gonna get into big trouble. What I discover as soon as I go out and do my fits, the background that I've given you in that particular case was where A fit, the underlying value was actually 0.4. So the residual background was 0.4 times an exponential. You actually see it has a hard time even finding a result at 0.4, okay? It wants to trade off the values of the mixing angle for that Hill term. And the same thing happens with delta m squared. What happens is that once I have this highly correlated background, it can find a chi-squared that is really, really good, that is very far away from the actual true value and the true signal that is in there. And what happens when you do that is that you no longer have your PG test work. It turns out that for this particular case, you end up with something which looks like this for your degrees of freedom, which is definitely not two. You keep making the background bigger and it even quits looking like degrees of freedom at all. So this is a case where it's not working.
Where did the 0.6 come from? Is that an overlap integral or what is that?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, we have a sharp cutoff at 1/4 past 3 always because we have.
Oh, no, I'm done cutoff. Before then. I can't.
We want to have a little bit of discussion maybe also, so we should be
ready
to finish soon. At least whatever.
Okay, I'm sorry about this. I don't usually do talks like this, so.
You take a few more minutes.
Correlation. It's your classic correlation.
People may want to say something about this as well at the end, so.
It's a shape correlation. Okay, so these guys are my background and my signal. This is the mean value if you average over them, I are the number of bins. And then the sigma f and the sigma g are the mean square deviations. So it's a pretty classic way of doing it.
So it's how much the shapes look the same.
The normalization doesn't matter in this case. And it turns out the normalization doesn't matter in this going wrong. It's really the shape. The smaller the smaller the overall effect when you do your fits and so forth, but you still end up with a problem even if it's small.
If you had two flat lines, would the correlation be one?
A flat line? The flat line, the correlation is equal to zero.
Zero.
Right, because it doesn't look anything like a signal, right? The signal looks like that.
Well, I mean, the signal looks like.
If I had gone to delta m squared of infinity, yeah, I would have gotten a correlation there.
If both curves were the same, the correlation would be.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, we have run the case where we put in a background that looks exactly like the signal and the correlation is 1.0, and the situation just gets worse. Okay, so this is a real thing that happens in real experiments. In fact, it is a real thing that happens probably in.
That when you put the error in the background, you got zero non-Gaussian.
What I do is I assume.
I just did not understand what is non-Gaussian in what you're doing.
Oh, what is non-Gaussian is that when I throw the 1,000 experiments, the residual, before I put in the statistical error on it, is always a single value.
Okay. It's not a chi-square.
It is not Gaussianly distributed around the zero. Okay? Okay. Oops, that's my next section. So we're trying to figure out what to do on this, and this matters, it turns out. The reason why this matters is because the mini-boom pie knots look exactly like this. And one of the very striking things that we discovered a few months ago, about a year ago, in fact, at this point, is that actually, if you change the mini-boom pie knot normalization by 1.4 sigma, which is a small amount, 1.4 sigma happens, then in fact, you get a very nice fit to the mini-boom data with the global fit. So the fact that mini-boom was causing a lot of problems in the appearance fit as measured through the PG doesn't seem, it doesn't all hold together. Something's going on.
Now I have to ask the question. I mean, if you mean you get a nice global fit, you mean you see stare in the appearance fit, or you don't see stare?
It just means that it agrees with the global fit, the chi-square degrees. It has nothing to do with what the result is at all when I say that. The reason why we do it with the toy model is so that we have some idea of what's underneath, because we don't have any idea of mini boom. But mini boom was the clue that something like this might be going on.
So if you drop the low energy data,
if you drop the low energy data, which is what GNT's group does, then you actually get good fits. Mm-hmm. Mini boom is a problem.
Do you have results for it?
We have done that, yeah. That's actually in our 2012 short baseline paper where we basically drop mini-boom entirely. We don't cut it at 475, but it doesn't matter because there's nothing above 475.
Right.
So all you're doing is adding chi-squared if you leave mini-boom in,
right?
So we don't do that, we just take it out. And we show that if you take mini-boom out, you get a much better fit all the way around. So we've been trying to figure out what's going on, and so we ran into this problem. So we've been talking to people about what to do about this, and one of the people that we've been talking to is Byron Rowe, who has written a book on statistics and thinks a lot about statistics. And he said, oh, why, yes, everybody knows that if your signal is correlated to your background, then when you do these calculations, you are going to get into trouble, okay? But actually, you can't find a lot about this on the web, so he wrote this paper, and this paper just appeared in September. And what he's proposing that we do is he's proposing that we penalize the fits for the correlation. So the idea is that you find out how correlated the data is. He works out a penalty term. I hate it too. I hate it.
Well,
let me just keep going on what I'm doing here first, okay? And then we can talk about it. This is an option, and if you really knew how to introduce that penalty term correctly, which you can do if you're doing toy models, then you're fine, right? But I am very worried about this, okay? I'm very worried that we don't get our penalty terms right. Now, one of the things that we have found with all of this is that even though you got the degrees of freedom wrong, even though your appearance fit went crazy, it turns out your global fit in this toy model comes out dead on, okay? The other data sets with different systematics, which was the point you were making at the beginning, they managed to be orthogonal to this problem. And so when you put all the data together, they managed to pull it back to where the real answer was. So it is possible that you can get around this by going ahead and putting in data sets where you have enough orthogonal systematic errors, okay? We don't have those data sets at the moment, but it is possible that that is a way to get around it. So we're thinking on this. We would like more ideas on how to approach this problem, okay? So that's my big thing. And then my last big thing that I wanted to say is that I don't want to spend the rest of my life doing fits. I really want to run experiments which will actually be decisive, and I'm trying to use these to understand how to build my experiment so that it can actually be decisive. And I've had people say silly things to me about building decisive experiments, as well as saying silly things to me about doing fits, okay? And one of them is, why on earth would you want to reach 5 sigma in less than a year? It's like killing puppies with elephant guns. And I was very hurt, because I don't kill puppies, I just want to say it, okay? But I think we have to get out of this sense, right, that we're in right now, that it is okay to be doing experiments which are relatively marginal or which will reach 5 sigma in 10 years. That is just not the kind of thinking we need to be doing, and we need to be trying to build experiments that don't do that. And one of the things that I will tell you is that the Fermilab Fermilab short baseline program right now is doomed, okay, to do this. What you see right here is you see the expectation for the Miniboon short baseline, the Fermilab short baseline program. What they've done is they have put on their 90% confidence level, 99% confidence level, and 5 sigma, and they show you the LS&D region, okay? This is an experiment which is running in neutrino mode, and remember, the Miniboon signal was sitting this way to the left, right? In fact, this 90% confidence level that you see right here, you can actually compare it to the actual final Miniboon sensitivity when we ran. So this was when we actually understood all of the issues about all of our systematic errors by building the experiment and doing all of the tests, okay? These people have the same sensitivity as we had at the end right now when they don't have all their systematic errors in. So this is just not going to make it. You can get experiments which do make it. To get experiments which do make it, you really need really high statistics and you need really low systematics, okay? There's a style of experiment that'll do it for you, and that's the decay at rest style experiments. There are two kinds of decay at rest style experiments, those which are the pion decay that I told you about, and also cases where you're doing beta decay. So you're doing driven beta decay like Isonar. Both of those will give you a lot more space that you can explore. And most importantly, in this particular case, which is OSCATS and S, you're comparing antineutrino sensitivity to antineutrino signal, okay? What I think we want out of experiments is to be able to reconstruct the oscillation wave, because it seems to me that it's likely things are more complicated than what you have in 3 plus 1. So if you want to be able to tell the difference between, say, 3 plus 1 and 3 plus 2, some experiment that I'm working on, which is called ISIDAR, is designed to, in 5 years, be able to trace out the oscillation waves so that we can understand what's going on in them. And you really want that 5 sigma sensitivity to be way over from where you have your allowed region here. Because you never know when somebody's going to come along and tell you, oh, the systematic error on this should be much larger, and suddenly it spreads out in this direction, right? Certainly you want to explore as much space as you possibly can, because there's going to have to be new E disappearance, which has got a higher mixing angle than the appearance result if this is oscillations. So this is the kind of thing you want to look for. Okay, so I thought I was supposed to end at 3, and I am. So I'm sorry, that was my assumptions on things, and I hope I didn't bore you.
Thank you very much, first of all. So, questions maybe?
Well, we talked about this thing about penalization on the correlation.
I don't want to do it either.
this really look like in your frequencies, and you do not want to do variation, but you want to use the concept of variation analysis, right? I mean, I think all of these issues have been discussed in the variation analysis like long ago.
I forgot to add the other comment that people make to me, which is, you're a closet Bayesian. They say that to me a lot.
So I think this is just a reminder of the fact that
So we're starting to look at something now where we're going to work on doing a more Bayesian approach to this and find out if we get the same results.
Yeah, but the thing is that chi-square only works if the things are chi-square distributed. Whenever you go away from Gaussian, then it's not chi-square distributed anymore. It's just like this T2K data on JavaScript.
Right, right.
So I looked at one of his recent papers on spreading out V, right? So
yeah.
Yeah, so he is one of the corporate.
Okay.
And
you're
the new guy.
You're the new guy. Okay. Well, so, but you guys don't go away from this in that paper.
No, you use chi-square.
Right. You guys are doing the same. I talk to Yakim all the time, so I know you guys are doing the same thing as we're doing.
Yeah. I think our
right.
team agree.
Right.
Our team agree quite well. We don't agree very well at Genesis.
No, and I don't agree with Shinji's fit either.
Yeah, I checked.
I mean, what I don't understand is you don't understand that the mini moon, your pi zero background, I mean, why don't you find a larger, like a shape error?
No. We're one, if you do this kind of a game that I was playing, we're only 1.4 sigma off. And if you think about all the backgrounds that we have, one background being 1.4 sigma is completely within the distribution that you would expect.
But you could in principle assign larger errors for all backgrounds, you don't trust it.
But I do trust it, is what I'm saying. 1.4 sigma is within when you assign these backgrounds, you're saying this is how much I trust it, right? And what you're saying is that when I go out and I take all of my backgrounds, and if I really knew the value of all of my backgrounds, right, then what I would expect is that the true backgrounds would end up being a Gaussian around, right? And so I'm saying that, yeah, so most of them are located right around here probably, and this one is sitting out here, but it's not very far out of the tail. 1.4 sigma is not something people would complain about. So it's not that we've got the background wrong. It's not that we should blow up the background. And I also think that posteriorly you should not blow up backgrounds. We might think about it if we were running a different, if we were running a minivan again. But I just don't think you should.
This is called an organization, right? You don't assume a shape error or something like this.
In this particular case, what I was doing was putting in a pull term that was a normalization pull term, because it is really, really painful to put in shape pull terms. I could do it, but that's a really painful thing to put in. And it turns out that, and I was just playing at the time I was doing that. I was trying to understand why it is that the it comes out looking so bad when you ask the PG test that this is bad, but when I look at the plot, it doesn't look so bad. And it's one of those things where you want to not just believe your test, you need to look at the plots too, right? And so you started wondering, well, why would this work this way? And that's where I ran into this. So then I wanted to back off, because I don't know what's really in anybody, right? I have no idea. But I do know what's in my toy model. And so I was able to sit down and construct something which I said, this is my model, I really do understand it. And there, you know, what I find is that actually, if I do my fits, I get the right answer. The global fit for my toy model was perfect. It really comes out dead on. Because as soon as you put in the disappearance, it completely is orthogonal to this background. It is, the disappearance is not correlated to that background at all, and it just says, okay, I'll go to this value.
So you didn't imply what you said before, that you could get a consistent fit for sterile neutrinos, right?
I'm not saying we're going to publish a paper saying we're getting consistent fits for sterile neutrinos. I want to develop what I should do. Now that I'm suspicious, I want to develop what I should do completely apart from the data that's out there. I want to understand what I found by looking at our data. I found what I think is a real problem, okay, this kind of correlation problem. I think we've demonstrated it really is a problem, and now we have to find a solution for it, but we should find that solution apart from the data, keep the data off some other place, and then go and fit it later when you figure out how to do this in a good fashion. I think that's the best way to approach it. I think you have to be really, really careful. You know, you really have to be able to show every step along the way. You have to think about your reasons completely separate from the data sets, I think.
Do we have other questions?
Yeah.
I have a related question. If you're allowing this one parameter to vary, this one systematic to vary 1.4 sigma, are you allowing all systematics to vary by a comparable amount?
All of the systematics are allowed to vary, yeah, because we have a correlation matrix. And so it can go ahead and vary them all in the fit. But if you are doing an appearance fit, what happens is that it gets a much smaller chi-square for the case because of the correlation. So yes, so we have a big correlation matrix. We have many, many backgrounds. There's 16 different entries in it. And they are all allowed to vary according to the errors.
So with your reanalysis or your insight into analysis, the neutrino data could become consistent with global fits, I guess. But it's not going to become consistent without CP violation
right.
The anti-neutrino data. Mm-hmm. Is that the conclusion?
Well, first of all, you have to believe that I'm doing the right thing for this, and I'm not believing I'm doing the right thing at the moment. I'm telling you what my clue was. I'm not telling you this is what you should do, okay? So I want to make that very, very clear. But one of the things I will tell you is that, yeah, that is something which is makes the 3+2 fit work.
Well, it would also be that you have some kind of independent, like your hypothesis.
It's harder to have that happen in an experiment like Mini-Boom than in a lot of experiments. Because the way that we get our backgrounds is by reversing the current of the horn. And so what we end up with is we end up with background shapes, for example, that are very, very similar in the two. It's a little tricky to do that, but the normalizations can vary a little bit.
I don't think you CP violation is actually an issue here. I think the problem comes when you compare disappearance with appearance. The
right.
CP violation comes whenever you want to explain immediately neutrino and antineutrino.
Right. So that's this one over
and
here.
This is not the intention, actually. It's compared to the all attention, this is like, it's okay.
I think he's asking, would this move this in this direction? The answer is no. It doesn't move it very much.
Yeah.
What happens is it messes up your test. It's not moving the data around, it's messing up your test. Once you put everything into the global, everything seems to work together. But your test ends up being messed up.
By what? I'm sorry. What's messing up?
By putting in a non-Gaussian systematic.
Oh, non-Gaussian.
His face was most painful thing. Okay. Then I think we should go for a coffee and cookies and thank Jenny again.
Thank you.
And we will have